First to my immediate left is Jefferson John Doggett. I've never actually called you Jefferson.
Never Jefferson.
John is the Executive Vice President of Public Policy for the National Corn Growers. As many of you know, he grew up on a Montana ranch. He has been 25 years in agriculture policy. He worked for the American Farm Bureau Federation, the National Cattlemen, and for Montana Congressman Ron Marlinet back in the time. In 2004, he was named one of the most influential lobbyists by the Hill. So in 2005, I hired Samantha Slater away from him, and he has not been one of the most influential lobbyists ever since. I have. Thank you, Samantha. Next to John is John Eichberger, who is the Vice President of Government Relations for the National Association of Convenience Stores, NACS. He joined NACS in 2001, or 2000, I guess. In 2013, he became the executive director of the Fuels Institute, a think tank managed by NACS. Independent, right? Independent?
Yes. Independent board of directors.
Independent think tank managed by NACS, by the vice president of government relations for NACS. Independent. That's good.
of which RFA is a founding member.
No. A proud founding member.
There we go.
John actually used to work for Congressman Greg Gansky. I think he sometimes regrets that I remind him of that all the time. But Congressman Gansky from Iowa served on the Energy and Commerce Committee, so I used to have to go in and lobby John, and that was always a tough sell. Because in those days, the late 1990s, when we were having all kinds of battles over the oxygen requirement, other staff on the Energy and Commerce Committee referred to you as Cornflake. I thought that was disrespectful. My name for John is Kellogg's. Bob Greco. Bob is the Group Director of Downstream and Industry Operations for the American Petroleum Institute. This is Bob's second time being here, and I really appreciate you walking into the Lion's Den. You are surrounded by nothing but friends, Bob, promise.
Hey, we're your customer, biggest customer.
Happy Absolutely. Without you, we wouldn't be able to sell 14.3 billion gallons a year. He's had a 25-year career at API. He also did a stint at the Environmental Protection Agency. He's got a degree in environmental engineering from Cornell. Go Big Red. Shane Carr, I really appreciate Shane being here again this year. He's a frequent panelist at this event, but he's coming today after having a terrible accident on his bicycle, his mountain bike. And so that's the reason for his cane, no other reason, I'm sure. Shane is the Vice President for Federal Government Affairs at the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. He's been there since 2007. Prior to that, he was with the Department of Transportation as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Government Affairs, and he had worked for Representative Doug Beirider from Nebraska. See, all the really smart guys work for Midwest Republicans. That's what I'm picking up from this. He's indeed smart. He's got his BA from Texas Christian University, his master's from Temple, and his law degree from Georgetown University. So that makes him a horned frog into an owl into a Hoya. So, thank you very much.
It was a good football year for me.
It was a good football year for you, wasn't it?
Not quite good enough. Not
so much for Georgetown.
Yeah.
Brooke Coleman is also a familiar face. He is the executive director for the Advanced Ethanol Council. He's been involved in biofuels since 1997 when he was with the Blue Water Network and had done a lot to make sure that California was sensitive to the role of MTBE in gasoline. He's from Boston, so he's very happy to be here. He's getting away from 7 feet of snow. But lest you think anybody in Boston is truly bothered by 7 feet of snow, Brooke will remind you that the Patriots won the Super Bowl, and the Sox are reporting, their pitchers and catchers reporting today, so all is right in the world for Bostonians. Brooke, thanks for being here. All right. Sometimes I try to do a casual warm-up question, you know, but we ain't doing that this year. We're just going to jump right on into it. So Now that Republicans control the House and the Senate, what do each of you think will be the consequences for the RFS and biofuels policy in the 114th Congress? John.
Gridlock continues.
That's it.
That's it.
Man, a few words. John.
They can't get out of their own way. I agree with John. Nothing happens.
Bob, save me here.
Opportunities increase. So we're sticking with the two-word
responses. Which opportunities?
Well, no, I think we're going to see a Senate that at least is having debates and taking votes. I'm not sure how that's going to play out, but we did not have that previously. So bipartisan support before for addressing the RFS. I'll be optimistic. I'll be the optimist on the group.
That troubles me.
Does it trouble you greatly?
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Well, in that case, if you got the bat, I'll rescind my remarks.
Is that all it takes?
See, this is what really happened to Shane. Right.
Shane, does the Ottawa Alliance even have a position on the RFS at this point?
Let's see. I testified last summer, so we must have had something to say. We would just like the implementation to work. And obviously the implementation is not working right now. And I think, to answer your question, it's going to depend a lot on what EPA does later this year, right, as to whether or not momentum comes back, because EPA effectively killed whatever momentum there was in the last Congress and then changed their minds, maybe perhaps thanks to some good lobbying. I think depending on what they do this year, you may see the momentum pick back up or not.
Well, as our new good friend from Tesoro, I think, made clear this morning, we all want implementation to work, and we all benefit from certainty. It just depends on what vision of the world you're going to start from. Are you going to start from API's vision of the world where no more than 10% ethanol ever, no way, no how, or the vision of our industry that you need to move beyond 10% blends, we need to be doing more to promote renewable fuels?
Well, I don't think, whatever your take is, I don't think you can say that implementation is working when the agency in charge of setting the number didn't even set the number in 14. I mean,
we all agree there, yes.
Yeah. So,
Brooke?
Over to you.
Okay. What do you think happens with the RFS this year?
Well, I think the political math is actually more difficult for opening up the RFS for the oil industry, for those that want to do it, than even it was last year. So you have, if you look at 2016, you have tremendous exposure in the Republican Party from agricultural states for the right reasons, because ethanol is a huge part of the GDP in those states. A couple dozen U.S. senators up on the Republican Party, and it's just going to be hard for McConnell and the leadership to justify going after the RFS. So I think there's a certain utility in saying it maybe will happen, particularly among those who dominate the marketplace now, but the reality is the political math is not clear, and it's muddier, I think, this year than even it was last year, given 2016.
Brooke, does cellulose continue to advance and be commercialized? Do we build the fifth plant, the sixth plant, in the absence of a working RFS?
I think it's a rate question. So I think when you fail to administer the RFS expeditiously, the rate of deployment commercially goes down, and the intrigue with regard to other opportunities overseas goes up. And so we will continue to have successes here, but if we want to have them and be the leader globally, then we have to get the RFS back on track. And I think the RFS is at a crossroads. I think it was going to be hard when we hit the so-called blend wall, which is really more like a blend step, and I think we'll work that out.
Bob, does API win just by having the debate, just by creating the uncertainty? You don't necessarily have to win a vote on the floor of the Senate to keep the rate of growth, as Brooke just said, from being something that you don't want to see.
No, I don't think that's an accurate statement. I think what the RFS has shown is that the mandates are not incentivizing the production the way its proponents thought it would. You know, Chris Gwendler, it was interesting. He had to acknowledge that all the growth in the cellulosic space is because they've changed the definition and incorporated biogas, which we've been producing from landfill for decades. We kind of reclassified it. So we're still waiting for those breakthroughs. I think the oil companies are some of the biggest investors in some of those second-generation cellulosic, but I think the fact that this program is poor implementation shows that just because you mandate it doesn't lead to these fuels being produced.
Brooke, you want to respond?
Well, first of all, I want to be precise here. Bob said all of the D3 cellulosic pool is biogas. That's not true. Quad Counties and Syngenta.
95%?
As a JV,
can you speak up?
Yeah, I think we what we're seeing now, if you look out over the landscape, is a lot of commercial plants deploying. This is going to be a big year for us, and I think it's a success story. I mean, you're talking about you get a lot of negativity in the cellulosic space, but when you look at the timeline, law signed 2007, rule completed 2010. Less than 5 years later, amidst a global recession and the freezing of capital markets, we have the deployment of the lowest carbon, most innovative fuel in the world at commercial scale. Sure, the RFS puts a lens on that, and relative to the standards, which are adjustable, we are not there, but it is an incredible success story, and I think the oil industry is not really fighting against corn ethanol. I think that's a stalking horse. They've swallowed corn ethanol from a blending perspective. What they're really fighting against is the next 21 billion gallons that's in the RFS.
See, I would disagree with you on that. The corn, the ethanol blend wall, you can call it whatever you want. It's a very real issue. It's a liability issue. It's a compatibility issue, not just with vehicles, but with service stations. And that space is where I think the challenge is. A lot of the second-generation fuels, if you got drop-in biofuels that are identical to the hydrocarbon molecule, you don't have those compatibility issues. So I think there is a future for those types of molecules, but they're just not coming along as quickly as they were touted to come along.
Bob, is it fair to say that some of those drop-in fuels, we don't know whether or not there are going to be compatibility issues yet because they've not yet been truly commercialized? And once there are drop-in fuels being produced at scale and having a meaningful impact, don't you kind of think API members are probably going to say, oh, there's that issue, or there's this issue?
So our members are investing in drop-in fuels or trying to make them work. As a chemistry background, if you got a molecule that looks like the same molecule, you're not expecting a compatibility issue. So I don't think that's the challenge. I think the challenge is commercializing them, bringing them in at scale at a price that's commercially viable and not the chemical compatibility of, again, it depends on, and I'm generalizing by saying it's an identical molecule. There are drop-in fuels that aren't. But from the standpoint of if you're producing a molecule the same as when it's already in the hydrocarbon stream, there shouldn't be a compatibility issue with that.
John, during the Keystone debate, there had been an amendment filed by Senators Feinstein and Toomey to eliminate the corn ethanol mandate. What was your view of that amendment? Do you expect to see it coming back? And what are the corn growers prepared to do when senators are going right at your industry?
Well, I think it could happen again. I think that probably the Senate will wait to see if the House does something first. That's one of the great options in Congress, that you let the other chamber go first when you weren't the first time successful in your chamber. I don't see it happening. I think we have the 40, 41, 42 votes in the Senate to keep a cloture motion from being successful. But, you know, we're going to have to continue to work on it. Our folks are very, very concerned about losing the RFS. Corn prices are half of what they were a few short years ago. But we all saw the precipitous drop in the price of food in this country, you know, which was brought to the attention of the entire nation, that we had a food versus fuel issue brought to us by our good friends. And, you know, they said food versus fuel is going to make food prices go up. So now corn prices are half what they were, and we all have noticed what a big drop we've had in food prices. Notice every time I go to the grocery store.
My wife will tell you, I don't go to the grocery store very often. So I'm not entirely certain what's going on with food prices. Enlighten me.
I imagine they would have
fallen.
You like would have thought so, because the folks, the proponents of food versus fuel, said that they were going up because of, you know, high corn prices. So you would think that the converse was true, but I don't know. I'm not an economist.
Ms. Dreigberger.
What I mean.
One of the things I could always count on you when you were a member of the staff of an energy and commerce member is that you knew how to count votes. You were great when Mr. Bilbray would be trying to run an amendment. You knew where everybody on the committee would be. As you look at the Senate EPW committee today, and you've got a chairman from the great state of Oklahoma, but you also have people like Senator Fisher, Senator Rounds. What do you think the political dynamic is on that committee with respect to this issue today?
It's not going to happen. They're not going to be able to do anything. I think Senator Chairman Inhofe has always been a loud critic of the RFS. I think that will continue. And from his position, he'll be able to make a lot of noise. He may have a lot of hearings. But in terms of mustering the votes to make significant changes, I think the only thing that could potentially precipitate Congress to actually take action and make change to the RFS is an economic situation. We saw a lot of momentum last Congress when the RINs prices spiked. We don't need to get into why RINs prices spiked, but once those prices hit their peak, a lot of people in Congress started paying real careful attention to what's going on. You started hearing a lot of rumblings about wanting to do something. Once those prices came down, everybody kind of quieted down and went to those separate corners again. I don't think you're going to see any momentum or any type of real loud rabble-rousing other than the traditional characters unless you see a significant economic impetus. Now, we can't project if that's going to happen, but if you do see that happen, you will see action. Will it result in anything? I am extremely doubtful. I don't think it can move out of the committees. Now, Congress has been known to bypass committees in the past. The Senate Majority Leader said they're not going to do that this time, but you know, things change when you start counting votes. But I don't think they have the votes to move it through Congress. If they do, they won't get it past the White House, and they don't have the votes to override. So for those who have asked me, do I think there's going to be changes to the RFS, I don't think so. There's going to be a lot of noise. There's going to be a lot of discussion. Maybe from that discussion, I mean, I agree with Bob. I agree with Shane. I think the RFS, as it's currently implemented, I think the long-term structure of it needs to be adjusted to make it sustainable in the long term. I don't think it's sustainable in its current format. Maybe from those knee-jerk reactions and conversations, maybe some ideas will percolate that make sense for a long-term solution to keep the industries, all the industries engaged, viable, and able to participate on an equal playing field.
Bob, do RINs drive gasoline prices?
A lot of factors drive gasoline prices. Crude oil is the biggest. 62% of the price of a gallon of gasoline is crude oil, which is why as crude oil prices have dropped 50%, or by $50, 50%, gasoline prices have come down as well. RIN prices are a cost to doing business to companies as they have to utilize. They utilize those. They're reported on their SEC filings. It's a cost to those companies, and at some point, these costs are handled in the company somehow. I can't predict whether it goes to the gallon of gasoline, but they aren't free.
But that's not what API has stated repeatedly. Your talking points all over Capitol Hill say that RIN prices have driven up the consumer price of gasoline.
No, they haven't. They have not.
Okay.
I would say it's comparable.
I'm going to take your statement not what I see on the hill. That's great.
At $1.70 a gallon, you had a lot of. I think as John mentioned, there's a lot of interest in that because when they did spike that high, even at 70 cents a gallon, it's a significant cost of doing business. That's all I can say. And I guess I'd similarly like your clarification, Bob, because I've heard you say both RINs are free, but you've also said that we need a high RIN price to support the gasoline, to support the ethanol development or biofuels development. Those seem to be contradictory statements.
But they're not. The RINs are free. Our companies give them to you. We give them to you.
Oh, okay.
We can't profit from them. We give them to you. And you sell them to other companies, and that does create value for those folks. And that should be the mechanism that drives investment in infrastructure. So, why hasn't it? Why hasn't API members, or haven't API members, invested in some of the infrastructure to make this program work? Shane's companies did. Shane's companies looked at the RFS and said, this is going to create a market for FFVs, and they built them.
let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
Okay, go ahead. Tell
so you're asking API, by API member company have not invested, and I'm assuming retail infrastructure to sell higher blends of ethanol. The API member companies have divested almost all their retail assets. So if you want to talk about retail infrastructure, you need to talk about the 150,000 independent retailers out there. The National Associated Convenience Stores represents 124,000 convenience fuel retailers. About 80,000 of them are single-store companies. There is a cost involved in infrastructure. A lot of my members are doing it. One of my biggest members is putting E15 in every station in North Carolina in the next couple of years because they made the investment in tankage early.
Give them the free advertising. What company was that again?
No, I'm not doing that. You've already done that. But they made the investment in compatible tanks and pipes when they built the stations. Something NACS has been advising our members for the last 10 years. Invest in the highest compatibility infrastructure you can so you can make flexible choices when the opportunities arise. Not everybody has that opportunity, and everybody knows what they have underground. Not everybody has the resources to invest in infrastructure. If you're asking the oil companies why they're not investing in retail, look, I can be quite honest with you, and I've said this in front of API all the time, there's not a lot of love lost between the retailers and their refiner suppliers. Nothing is free. Everything a retailer gets, even if they're branded or unbranded, everything they get from their supplier is paid back, usually double or triple. So there is nothing free. So if you're asking API, why aren't you investing in infrastructure, it's not they're not going to do that. Ultimately, the retailer is going to pay for it, and the consumer is going to pay for it. Retailers are investing when they think it makes economic sense and they can get a return on investment. And that's why you're seeing the growth in markets. But it may not be at the pace you want, but there is growth in the market.
Bob, are you satisfied with John's defense of you?
No, yeah, I do, but thank you, John.
And that's the first time I've ever defended
Probably the last time, too. But the comment about FFVs, we looked at the number of models, FFVs being marketed by the automakers. Just looking at models, not sales, but the number of models offered. It peaked 2 years ago, number of models, and it's dropped about 50% since then. Mm-hmm. So that suggests to me that there is less interest in investing in FFVs and producing FFVs. That also says to me that based on what I know about the CAFE requirements, there's a reason why they are investing in FFVs. And I think it really calls into question the viability of future FFV markets just based on that that trend right now. Unless it turns around, I don't see FFVs as a growing market share.
Shane, are you comfortable with Bob speaking for you? This is incredible. I got everybody speaking for everybody else right now. I'm about to speak for you too now.
All right, great. No, I don't dispute Bob's data. I think you have two things going on, though. One, obviously, the administration, which on the one hand says that they're very supportive of the RFS. On the other hand, in the CAFE and GHG rulemaking for autos, are in the process of phasing out the FFE credit. So, my members aren't getting compliance credits for building those vehicles. But at the same time, as you well know, with the E15 decision, a number of my members have moved to building E15 compatible vehicles. And frankly, Bob, I mean, as we look at the landscape, and then this goes to the implementation and what's really going on out there, E15 certainly doesn't soak up 36 billion gallons, but nobody thinks we're going to be at 36 billion gallons in my 6-year-old's lifetime. And thus, building E15 vehicles soaks up as much renewable fuel as my guys can see coming anytime in the over the near horizon or even farther horizon. Just as what it is.
Brooke, you've been uncharacteristically quiet here.
Yeah, well, I'm listening. A couple of things. The first is that I think there's a lot of baloney when it comes to RIN discussions, and one of the things that happens when you're talking about RINs, if you're incumbents, is it's all about cost. So to be clear, there are costs and profits. So some of the API members make a heck of a lot of money playing in the RIN game. And it's not really a cost of doing business. It's a cost of voluntarily refusing to comply with the law with liquid gallons. And so, I think people in the White House, for example, get confused and they think there's no way out of this box. And it's very easy to get out of the box. You blend more ethanol, you store ethanol, you sell ethanol, and you sell RINs to people who don't want to do it. And so one of the silver linings, and this is to John number two's point, in this whole process.
Which one is one and two?
Well, we got one at the end and two. I don't mean anything by that. is when RIN prices went up, we had an opportunity to talk to Congress about what a RIN was. We all went through this, right? Before RIN prices went up, we went in there, and our strategic consultant said, if you mention RINs and kill this meeting talking about renewable identification numbers, I'll kill you. And then, a year later, we have members of Congress saying, no, tell me what a RIN is, after they said, absolutely, I don't want to know. So we went through this process where Congress now knows what a RIN is. They now know that some oil companies profit from RINs, et cetera. Last point is, we're at a crossroads. So the auto industry is going to respond to what it sees. And so the RFS said, we're going to do this. And by this, I mean a heck of a lot of renewable fuel. The recent proposal from the White House said, well, maybe we're not sure. And you're going to see a consequence of that. But I don't think anybody in this room should think that we didn't just dodge a bullet in November 2014, because that was the proposal that did not happen. And I think that was the oil industry's best shot at changing this rule, and I think now we're just going to see it come back.
John, number one. Shane just sort of indicated that EPA's failure to implement the statute has impacted his company's decisions about FFVs. What has that done for farmer decisions for planting? What do you expect to happen this year?
I would imagine this year we're going to have significantly fewer acres of corn planted.
You want to put a number on it?
Nope. But I do want to talk about, the so-called independence of these 160,000 gas station operators. A whole lot of them, maybe not all your members, but a whole lot of them have franchise agreements. We've all seen the franchise agreements. We all know what franchise agreements say about things like E85 pumps. Come on. Really. Well, we happen to have some, I think.
Bob Greco has never seen a franchise agreement?
No.
Well, we're going to have to make sure you see one.
That's a arrangement with our members. That's not something I should or would see.
But we should point out that in the 2000 Energy Act, I helped craft amendments to the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act to open the door for E85 through branded contracts. That was NACS. We did that.
You cracked the door open. Swing it.
No. We changed PMPA on contracts going forward, not abrogating existing contracts. Contracts going forward, they cannot prevent E85 from being sold on the canopy. 50% of retailers are branded. 50% are not. The most progressive retailers in this country are unbranded. Are they jumping on the bandwagon to sell these fuels?
Your biggest member is.
Some of them are in
your
some markets.
Your biggest member.
Now, he said one of my biggest. Okay. But not all of them. They're doing it where the market is telling them this makes sense. It is not happening in every market. It cannot happen in every market, and it can't happen for every retailer. Market conditions are very specific to the store in which it's being operated. What's my infrastructure? What's my supply range? What's my ROI? What's my customer base? What's my flex fuel vehicle count in my market? All those things have to be weighed and measured before a retailer is going to make an investment in a fuel that may not return a profit. Keep in mind, putting a new fuel in is a lot different than putting a new candy bar in. If I put a candy bar in, you don't like it, I take it off, put another one there tomorrow. If I put a new fuel in, it's a much bigger conversion, much bigger cost to make that switch. And we're going to be a lot more careful about those decisions than on any other product we sell.
But one of the factors has got to be, what does my supply agreement allow me to do? Because there are absolutely refiners out there that prohibit their franchisees from offering E15. Or for selling a fuel that is not theirs, and have absolutely had an impact on what is ultimately available to the consumer.
Yes, all suppliers have that. McDonald's, you cannot buy Pepsi in a McDonald's. Why? Because Coke owns that contract. If McDonald's wants to change the contract at the end of the term, they can do that. All right? But 50% of retail stations selling fuel are not branded. They're not beholden to those restrictions. What's happening in that 50% of the market? And that should tell you what the marketer appetite is for these new fuels. And it's growing. I'm not ever going to say it's not growing. I got a lot of retailers calling me on a regular basis. What do you think, John? What should we do? And my advice is to make sure you do the right thing. Make sure you follow the law. Make sure you market appropriately. Make sure you ask all the questions you have to ask. Keep yourself out of legal trouble. And if you think you can make money on it, go for it. Why not?
Bob, so we're at the blend wall. What are your suggestions for how we move through it? What would you have us do?
Right now, we would like EPA to finalize the rule based on the proposal for 2014. We've got that. That's the last official
rule. What's the point of that? We know that there was 13.6 billion gallons that were blended last year.
No,
why
yeah,
would you finalize a 13 billion
if
gallon?
If you're counting EMTS, that includes gallons that are in storage. I don't think the imports have been backed out of that yet.
Yeah.
So let's be careful what we're counting on that. So I think the only official information we've had since EPA proposed it was the proposal. Nothing's been released since then. I'm concerned when I see Chris Brendler say that he's going to repropose last year's standard. That gives me some pause because we had 300,000 comments last year to the standard. You're going to do 3 years together over the summer. I'm guessing this is going to be a big effort on their part, and I don't see this getting finalized quickly. I think it's going to be as contentious. It's not like this is less controversial than it was last year, particularly if you're doing 3 years' worth. So our focus is on the blend wall because right now we know about how much vehicles, how much ethanol they can take right now. I think the market at the end of the day should be driving this, not the mandate. And if there's a market demand for more than 10%, let the market move that forward. Again, this is the floor for ethanol blending. It shouldn't be propping you all up. If you got a great product, so let it be the floor and compete above that.
I can't believe somebody who's a recipient of so many tax incentives is talking about the government propping us up.
But, let's talk about taxes for a
minute.
I'll be happy to talk taxes.
We will get there. We will get there. But, yeah. Brooke, do you want to respond?
Yeah, it's predominantly not a price-driven marketplace. So the oil industry likes to talk about competing and above 10%. If it was a price-driven marketplace, we'd be swimming in ethanol because ethanol is so far and away the cheapest octane enhancer. And you'd be swimming in ethanol if you just compared it to the wholesale price of gasoline over a large period of time.
How about right now?
And so, you can grab moments in time, yeah, where the price is closer. But
even today was still the lowest price octane.
By several dollars.
Again,
let me finish. This free market thing is before you even get outside of the United States, a complete fantasy. And then once you get outside, you see OPEC, and they are actually openly, in implementing a program that is in essence predatory, and you cannot sit there and say go compete when you have OPEC colluding openly to control price. That will dampen innovation, and you need policy to fix that.
Bob, I had asked you though, what would you do to get through the blend wall? And your response was
let the market
promulgate the last.
And let the market.
But the market. The RIN mechanism is a market-driven mechanism. Why not allow that to work?
If the consumer demand is there, again, EPA can provide you a floor ethanol blending. There's no reason it can't be blended. Ethanol is a good blending compound. Ethanol adds octane, helps with environmental compliance. The oil industry is not anti-ethanol. It's anti-ethanol mandates. So the concern that we have is that you ought to allow the market to reassert itself, allow our customers to buy the fuels they want. Sometimes it's E0, sometimes it's E10. Let the market dictate any growth beyond that. Over time, you're going to have new vehicles come to the market. I don't know if there's going to be growth in E15, if E85 growth has continued to drop. How do you predict that? And we know one, and even Chris Grunder will acknowledge, the government's a pretty lousy predictor of fuel demand. So I'd rather have faith in the market to determine that than have the government pick those numbers.
Brooke.
I mean, this is you referred to this in your State of the Industry earlier. This is a relitigation of a discussion that happened in 2007 that the oil industry lost. So we know what the oil industry wants, right? They supported the first RFS because it didn't go above 10%. They did not support the second RFS because it went well above 10%. The recognition of Congress at that time was that the market needed a policy instrument to drive low-carbon fuels, and they went and put it in place. So the whole thing about let the oil industry decide, that was rejected by Congress, and that's where we stand today. And I understand why Bob wants to relitigate that, because there's a chance he might win, but it's not a big chance.
And the world has changed since 2007. It was the Energy Independence and Security Act. It wasn't the Rural Development Support Act.
Oh, no.
Energy
no.
Independence and Security.
What it was called is meaningless. It had several objectives, and one objective most certainly was to create a value-added market for farmers because $2 corn was not sustainable. Another important objective was to move this country towards some semblance of low-carbon fuels, and those two objectives are as important today as they ever have been. Just as this gentleman, the price of corn today is what?
Below $4.
Below where it was when the act was passed.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't recreate history and say, well, this was just about energy independence, and now that we're fracking our way to energy independence in North Dakota, this program is an anathema. No, it's not. It's every bit as relative today as it was then.
We'll have to disagree on that. The fact is, we are an energy superpower right now. We're producing 70% more crude oil domestically than we were back then. This was passed at the peak. Gasoline demand was projected to grow at that time as well. Greenhouse gas emissions were growing. All of those have changed. And it's because of increased oil production, increased natural gas production from fracking. That's what's driven down nationwide CO2 emissions. That's ask EPA.
And increased ethanol production.
I'm sorry. You guys have done very well. We've increased oil production 3.7 million barrels per day, decreased imports by 2.6 million barrels per day. We've added 322,000 barrels per day of ethanol as well. Which number is driving oil imports down? It's oil production. The numbers are pretty plain on that.
At $45, $50 a barrel oil, though, rig counts are falling.
It was that price when this was passed.
Rig counts are falling.
Go up, and it's a cyclical industry. Welcome to the fuels industry. Guess what? So you have lost my mic here. Play by design. The long term, I think that the trend is for growth in energy, both from ethanol, both from hydrocarbons, from other sources as well. The world's going to need more energy. Primarily, the growth will be in Asia and Africa and elsewhere. U.S. liquid demand is flat, if not declining, at this point. So it's good that both the ethanol industry and the refining industry are looking to expand exports. We're producing record amounts of gasoline in this country despite using less than the domestic market. Why? Because we're exporting it. That's how free trade works. So I think that's a good thing. I think we can agree that
we ought to be exporting as much of our domestic fuels as possible. Shane, I got to get you back into this conversation. What are the alliance's top legislative priorities these days?
This also shows you how the world has changed and sort of where our guys are. What are the things I'm paying attention to? We had a couple of high-profile recalls last year, and there's still a lot of fallout discussion about those that will continue in the course of this year. Toxic substances reform is something that you're going to see a lot of activity on this spring, and will it get over the goal line? I don't know, but there's a lot of movement there. I think everybody's focused a little bit on TPA and trade. My association is not do TPP because I have Asian members and I have American members or U.S. headquartered members. But we are very focused on TTIP and trying to get that ball rolling. So, those are the big ticket items, reflecting where we started this conversation. I don't think anybody sees right now a significant push legislatively on the RFS. Chairman Upton released his energy architecture, and this wasn't a component of it. It's clearly not where they want to start. But if this discussion and debate picks up, then we'll be back in the middle of it.
John, number one, what are the corn growers?
Give you the same answer I gave you last year. Number one is protect the RFS. Number two is to protect the RFS. Number three is to protect the RFS. If you ask me for what number four is, passage of TPA. But we got to hold on to the first three.
John, what about the convenience stores?
We are refreshingly diverse with the breadth of what we do. We're focused on payment card data security, mobile payment introduction, trying to make sure that the credit cards don't rape and pillage everybody that's accepting cards on a daily basis. We're working on issues such as making sure lottery tickets aren't sold online. We're looking at tax reform and how that affects LIFO reserves and those type of things. So we're looking at a lot of things like that. The last couple of years, we've been working a lot with you guys on liability reform for fuels. And I want to point out something. If you think about all the opposition you've heard from the Naxos organization regarding RFS and higher blended fuels, it all comes down to one thing. Our legal system is a mess. I was talking to a guy down in Brazil, a good friend of mine, and I said, I'm down in Sao Paulo. I see motorcycles running around E25. I know you guys have lawnmowers and stuff. In the United States, you're not allowed to use E25 in those vehicles. How do you deal with it? Don't you have problems? He said, you know, John, sometimes you do have problems with engines, but in Brazil, when you have a problem, you call a mechanic. In the United States, you guys call a lawyer. If you think about it, we were looking for liability reform on equipment compatibility to improve the number of devices we have that are truly compatible but not officially listed to bring them into legal status. We looked at liability protection for misfueling. We looked at liability protection for selling a product that's legal today that somebody decides in 5 years is no longer legal and is defective. We don't want to be held retroactively responsible. All three of those, in my opinion, make absolute perfect common sense. Congress, however, is gutless when it comes to legal reform. What we all should be working on is coming together and actually advocating for a change to our legal system to provide some certainty to business leaders who want to bring new products to market. That's where we've been. If you want to look at the retailer concerns about E15 and other fuels, it comes down to what's my liability. And if we can address that, I think you're going to see a lot of hurdles drop to your market.
Bob, when I think of what your member companies are facing these days, your legislative agenda must be pretty expansive. You got pipelines, you got taxes, you got exports, you got the ozone rule, you got fracking regs. Right? What are your priorities? I mean, can you prioritize them? And where would you put the RFS in all that stuff?
RFS is a mission critical priority for our organization.
So that's like five?
Yeah. It's a top issue. So is exports, so is KXL, getting that approved, 6 years and counting. Infrastructure, clearly an important focus. Expanding both pipeline, rail, something you're familiar with as well. We want to make sure that we get the permits and the ability to expand our infrastructure to meet growing production needs. So we have a diverse membership because we cover everything from exploration production through transportation to refining to marketing. So covers the waterfront, but you kind of cover the main ones. Refinery sector rule, another EPA rule on refinery controls, but ozone clearly is a big rule for us as well as the business community broadly.
But is the RFS number one or number two?
It's a top issue. We group them. It's one of our top priority issues.
I think everybody in this room ought to be a little bit nervous about that.
He's already passed Keystone. He's got to work on something.
We did?
Passed.
I didn't check my email? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's not going to be signed.
I didn't say signed.
Brooke, I can argue with you.
Brooke, what's the most important thing that Congress could do to further commercialize or help commercialize the cellulosic sector?
I think the simple answer is stay out of the RFS fight legislatively and help us get it back on track administratively. That's number one. Two, and this one's harder because the first one requires really no action and a lot of advocacy.
Actually, Congress does no action pretty well.
Yeah. that's what I'm saying. You know, this next one does not require no action. Balancing the tax code is a big deal for us. Right now, the tax code suggests to investors that they should go and invest in oil to create the marginal gallon of fuel. Inequity is not defensible. The problem from a tax reform perspective is just political process, and it's at this point, it's very hard to get the tax reform process through that political hole. The third piece is market development and understand that expanding markets for ethanol is an advanced ethanol, cellulosic ethanol issue at least as much as it is an issue for other types of ethanol.
Brooke has talked about providing some balance in terms of tax policy, and we had started to engage that conversation earlier, but how does the oil industry, that is such a well-established industry, that is so profitable, justify maintaining the tax incentives that you continue to receive?
First off, the oil industry is a heavily taxed industry. We pay $85 million a day, taxes, fees, and other monies to the government. Our effective tax rate is about 44% internationally, 24% domestically. Both of those are above manufacturing averages. So this is not an industry that is lightly taxed. Regarding the various taxes...
It is an industry that's kind of profitable, though.
This year wasn't one of our better years. But even on a cents per dollar of sales, we're below the industry average. These are big companies and multi-billion-dollar companies that make billion-dollar profits. When you have a $300 billion company that's making $10 billion, you have to keep in mind the scale of the companies that you're dealing with here. So when you actually do the cost on a sales average, we're slightly below the manufacturing average for the U.S.
Profitability in the corn industry is not going to be so good this year, okay, just so we're kind of real clear on that.
Well, yeah, you've got company on that one this year.
You know, the big thing on this, so we're in a different place on tax, right? So you have a big established industry, and Bob says we get taxed, and, you know, I understand that, and that's the lens he's looking at it through. From an innovation perspective, the impact of the tax code is much more profound because it's all about risk. And so what these policies do is they de-risk investments of a certain type. And from an investment perspective, with regard to people who don't really care whether they invest in the next gallon of petroleum or the next gallon of bioethanol or the next gallon of butanol, if they look out and see an equity, they don't want to have to go to their boss and say, yeah, you know, I recommended an investment against the tax grain here, because that's how you get fired if you're an investor. So getting taxed is one thing, but dampening innovation and de-risking one industry investment over another is not something that this country should continue to do.
Let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about infrastructure. We've touched on it with respect to its impact on the RFS. But, Shane, you want to outline for a minute the different infrastructure challenges that might be facing an auto company looking at an electric vehicle versus an FFV?
Sure. I mean, that is the challenge of bringing on a bunch of different alternative powertrains. I think EPA keeps track or EIA keeps track of all the various fueling stations, and you can just go on their website and see that as relatively few FFV pumps as there are to gasoline pumps, there are even relatively significantly fewer electric charging stations. And so, if you follow the EV industry at all, you see in that sector a lot of the same discussions that are going on here. You know, how do we develop a charging network? And there's a major announcement by PG&E out in California last week or the week before that that they're going to start putting in charging stations. I think the state is giving them working with them significantly to do that. I think that they also may be raising rates on the rest of their customers to do that. And the state's kind of clearing the way for that, so that's kind of controversial. There are hydrogen vehicles, right? There aren't any hydrogen fueling stations to speak of. This is the problem for us, right? We are facing regulations at the federal level, regulations in California that are pushing different powertrains, and we can build the vehicle, but we're not in charge of the infrastructure anymore. So then we are in charge of gasoline stations, fueling stations. So it's a challenge across the board.
John, will your members face significant and costly infrastructure hurdles if there are more electric vehicles out there? I mean, how is your industry preparing for electric vehicles?
I've told my members, because I've done a lot of evaluation of the EV market, EVs are not an opportunity nor a threat to the convenience retailing industry. The existing model for EV is a 40-mile round-trip consumer who can recharge at home, recharge at the office. It is highly unlikely that we're going to see a market development where they're going to need to have an in-transit recharging point on a frequent basis. Currently, the level 2 chargers require a long time to give you any type of charge. You know, we were out at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory last spring, and I asked a couple of the scientists there. I said, okay, is there a breakthrough on the horizon where an electric vehicle battery can take a charge in, say, 5 minutes and get 80% recharge? The response was probably not, but even if there was, the grid is not equipped to deliver that kind of charge. That tells me that this in-transit recharging on a quick basis is so far removed from where we currently are and will require such an infrastructure investment, I don't really see it as a threat. Some of my guys are putting in EV. Why? Because they get their name put up on the computer screen on every electric vehicle. It's a great marketing tool. You know, and they can do it for $20,000 or less if they ran the conduit early. But we don't really see EV as the big threat. We're looking at other things that are much more conducive to our channel of trade and the amount of time people want to spend in a convenience store, which is a couple minutes, not 20 to 30.
Shane, with so many of your companies now approving the use of E15 in their warranty statements, does the Auto Alliance have a position on E15?
No, we don't, which shouldn't be all that surprising, because for antitrust reasons, we don't get into product planning and in particular future product planning of our members. So no.
There's a congressman from Wisconsin who likes to rail all the time about how the auto companies don't support E15, and he's got letters from years ago that he likes to trot out. Have you ever thought about letting him know that the world is changing and that now there are many, many companies that are approving the use of E15 in their vehicles?
Well, I think Mr. Sensenbrenner's staff is well aware of that. I think that they remain concerned about, as do we, about legacy vehicles and about engines that aren't warranted, and small engines. Chris Kaiser
that aren't
stuck
allowed
in
to
DC
use
this year. That's right. I think they're well aware.
Because I'd love to be on a letter with you and maybe just remind him that the world is an evolving place and that there are now all these companies that are providing warranty coverage.
Are we writing joint letters now, Bob?
I think we should. Right here, right now. We've only got a couple minutes left. And with such an august body of political prognosticators, it would seem...
Here we go. Right.
It would seem just horrible of me not to give you the opportunity to comment on something impacting the 2016 election. You make a prediction on who the nominees are going to be. You can make a prediction in terms of the control of the House or the Senate or both. But, John, what would you suggest?
I would suggest that probably we're going to go with the governor on the Republican side. I think that the nation has decided that maybe they don't want to see another United States senator halfway through their term with a couple of years in the state legislature occupy the White House. I think that that's not going to be the model that's going to be followed. So I think you're looking at a governor on the Republican side. And I think that we'll have to see on the Democratic side.
We'll have to see, really? That's all you can offer?
Here's the thing. Historically, a year out from the convention, the Republicans normally nominate the leader a year out from whoever's in the lead a year out from the convention. The Democrats almost never do.
Kellogg?
There is a big chance, to counter your point, that the Republicans go to a brokered convention because so many states are doing not winner-take-all status in the primary process, which is a big challenge for the Republican Party. I think my feeling is the 2014 election, while the Republicans hailed it as a great victory, was a very, very dangerous predicament for them because now they're going to get blamed for everything that happens because they got the House and Senate. They don't have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, so they're not going to be able to get anything controversial through that they want to get through. They got a veto in the White House, and the Democrats are going to pillory them as the party of inaction. Now, I use the word pillory for a reason. I started voting when Mr. Bush was first in office. So it would be interesting to see, at some point in my life, I would love to see a presidential contest where there wasn't a Bush or a Clinton somewhere in the mix. It's really, I'm getting tired of voting for the same person all the time, and it's just getting tiring.
Bob, what do you think?
I'll pass. I'd much rather wear Brooke and Shane after
this. Oh, no. And I'll ask you a more specific question. In the state of Iowa today, candidates going to the state are asked a question about the RFS and their support for it. Do you think that that issue will have an impact on the election?
I think there are 49 other states that have to be part of that conversation, and it's going to be a different conversation in each of them. And I know we're talking to the candidates. I know you're talking to the candidates. And I think the message is going to be look at the entire map as you're considering your positions on fuels.
Shane?
So I worked at the Department of Transportation as a political appointee under Bush 43, so I'm not as troubled by John as a Bush in the election. Maybe I'll just leave it at that.
Brooke, don't dodge, please.
It said zero for a very long time. I don't think it's going to be Bush, Clinton.
You don't think it's going to be Bush or Clinton?
No, I said Bush, I don't think it's going to be Bush v. Clinton. I think that'll be rejected by the voters before we get there. I think opposition research might play a role. And maybe Bernie Sanders is going to come up from Vermont and take it.
Down from Vermont.
From Vermont.
The New England guy comes through for Bernie Sanders. The snow really is getting to
Don't tell Warren.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You give this panel a round of applause. Thank you. Okay.
When I came up on the stage, somebody handed this to me and said, use this on Bob if you need to, but they didn't differentiate which Bob.
I think we both know which Bob.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Thank you, folks.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.